Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Well, hello, muy buenas. How are you today? This is Kit.
And I'm Penny. Good morning.
And a warm welcome to Talk Radio Europe's magazine show, the programme that takes you from the exotic to the everyday, from the ecstatic to the exasperating, and celebrates those grey areas in between. Yes, we're talking about our lives in Spain from what you might call the expatriate point of view. Well, last night I woke up in the middle of the night, except it wasn't the middle of the night. It was 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, lucky are you. You didn't wake up till 8.
Well, it's just so dark.
It's very dark,
isn't it?
I've never worked it out, and I probably never
will.
Well,
it's because the clocks are due to go back, but I don't think they do until a couple of weeks.
So. I think it's the 27th they go back.
So, yes, so it will be still be pitch black at 8:15 by the time they do go back. But anyway, so what's on the show today? Our autumn series, Caminos of Iberia, finds us still in the green, glorious folds of the Asturias, from where we not only sample the singular cuisine of the region, but discover the rite and ritual of drinking cider in La Sidrería. Now, if we don't exactly experience October in mists and mellow fruitfulness here in Mediterranean Spain, there is nonetheless a sense of cosecha, of harvest, of algarrobos, persimmons, chestnuts, and in Castilla-La Mancha, indeed, the gathering of something fine, fragile, and elusively delicious.
We're going to be talking to Eric from the Spanish Touch, who's going to show us around the saffron fields of Castilla-La Mancha.
Because it is the saffron harvest now, yeah?
Yes, exactly. Whether it's today or next week, I don't know. But it's very soon. I don't know when they actually sprout. Does a crocus sprout? Yes, when they actually come out of the ground. But yeah, it's a very technical, and it only lasts literally a few days. So I don't know if people are hovering. We'll ask.
Delicate to touch,
about
delicate to taste. Yes, as a fran. Last week we talked about beer and beer festivals. Well, this week we amplify the alcoholic theme somewhat, because not only do we drink cider, but we celebrate another of the season's harvest, la vendimia here in Spain, la vendange in France, the grape harvest, from humble grape to vintage wine with Richard Bell Young, who joins us at home from 12:20 today. Food, drink, and good company. What more could you want?
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Now, our need of a supermarket notwithstanding, today appears to be a fiesta.
It is. It's October the 12th. Is it October the 12th? Yes, it's October the 12th. And if nobody has noticed, you are about to notice that this is the Día de la Hispanidad. It's a national holiday across Spain, and officially it's the Fiesta Nacional, and it's also the Día de Hispanidad. So this is a holiday which has changed a bit over the years, and I'll try and explain it. Bit like Christmas really here, isn't it? Things tend to change. It commemorates the day when Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas in 1492.
Ah, does it?
And it's also Armed Forces Day. So, what happens? And why does Spain celebrate it? This is a bit of history, Kit. I hope you're listening.
I am.
There may not be much mention of the explorer himself, but the date October the 12th commemorates the discovery of the Americas by Christopher Columbus. Now, his name, also I didn't know this till early this morning, is Cristóbal Colón in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you see a street named Colón or an area of a town, Colón, that is why. I didn't realise it was that.
How long have you lived here?
I didn't realise that. I kind of thought that names didn't necessarily need translating. I mean, if you had Kit Hogg Street, what's Hogg in Spanish?
I've no idea.
Yes,
but Columbus is an English translation of Colon.
Yeah, I didn't realise that.
I suppose to avoid the connotations of colon, I'm not sure. But
yeah,
anyway.
Who knows? Anyway, Christopher. On that day in 1492, a Spanish expedition led by him arrived to what is known today as San Salvador in the Bahamas and made the first step towards what would become the Spanish Empire. Spain conquered the south of what today is the United States and a great part of the western coast of South America. And together with the other territories that the Spanish realm had already conquered, it made Spain the empire and the greatest of its time. The Hispanic Day also commemorates the unification of the realms of Castilla and Aragon, which created Spain as we know it today, an event that happened earlier in 1492, after the Spanish army reconquered Granada, the last stronghold of the Moors in Europe. A busy year, eh?
Yes, a seminal year in Spanish history.
Yes, very busy year. I'm going to try and remember that.
1492.
Quite a long time ago.
In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Yes, yes, I'll have that forever etched on my forehead. Now, the Dia de la Hispanidad first began being celebrated in Madrid in 1935 and was made an official public holiday in 1981. In 87, its name was changed to Fiesta Nacional, removing any reference to Spanish colonialism. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
The controversy, there's a bit of controversy about this, around this celebration, and it's no surprise to learn that the biggest criticism comes from Catalonia, the region pushing for independence. Some political parties in the Basque Country and Navarra also refuse to mark Hispanic Day. Basque nationalists are absent for the same reason as the Catalan separatists, and in Navarra, the regional government replaced the Dia de Hispanidad with the Dia of the Day of the Indigenous peoples, okay, which is really to, they're saying, their argument is that celebrating Columbus Day would mean celebrating the genocide that followed the discovery of the New World.
And that happens today, the Indigenous peoples.
Yes, that's...
So they get a holiday anyway.
Yes, exactly, but they're just calling it in a celebration of something else to acknowledge the Indigenous people who were there in the very first place. Also, in many people's minds, the day still has strong associations with the Francoist era when the dictator used the celebration to display his military might and extol the values of dictatorship. So, anyway, there's a fly past by, do you know what the Spanish name for the red arrows, their red arrows is?
Las flechas rojas.
It's the Patrulla Águila.
Ah, right, the Eagle Patrol. I like that.
Eagle Patrol, yeah, yes, that's that, the Spanish red arrows, yes. And that will have the other, in Malaga, there's a big military procession in the park, in Central Park. Huelva, Zaragoza, everywhere. And in the Hispanic world, there are celebrations. Do you remember, actually, we came across that? Was it in Algeciras? No, here in San Pedro. We came across
La Legion with the goat.
Yes, we did.
The mascot goat.
Yes,
that wasn't the Dia de España, though, darling. No, that was some San Pedro festival.
Yeah,
but it was splendid nonetheless.
Yeah, the
guy with the tassels on the hat.
Yes, yeah. They had their shirts unbuttoned right down to their belly button.
That's it, with the pendants.
Most suggestive.
Very Hispanic, it was. Yeah. Now, if you were at Home with the Hogs last week, you may remember us opening a packet of Conguitos. The chocolate confectionery that is emblazoned with the logo of an African Pekinini, a caricature which would cause a storm of protest in the inflamed wokeness of Britain, but which here in Spain apparently fails to bat an eyelid. And that in itself, it occurs to me, is an interesting contrast in attitudes to race between the UK and Spain. And as that discussion develops, to immigration itself. And just to accentuate that, I was listening earlier this week when I wasn't, actually, I have to confess, I wasn't listening to TRE. I was listening to Radio 4, just briefly.
No.
Where studio guests were discussing, it's a thing called Start the Week, and studio guests were discussing a thing called subconscious racism. Now, racism I've heard of, but subconscious racism is a new one to me. And apparently it leads to microaggressions. Now, the person leading this discussion gave an example of a subconsciously racist microaggression, and it could be that a white person is asking someone who isn't a white person, where are you from? Can you relate to that? A white person asking someone, it's all in the emphasis of the question, isn't it?
Yeah, or the intonation, really.
The PC woke opinion here is that this question is a microaggression and that you shouldn't ask a person of colour or of someone who isn't necessarily white where you're from. And it occurred to me that this insecurity and ability to write, to take offence has reached stratospheric proportions. I mean, whatever you do in this atmosphere of hysterical oversensitivity, don't say,
spit it out,
pass the congitos.
No.
But and as a way of grounding ourselves in possibly a consensus of common sense, I thought we might look at how things are here in Spain. And this book I'm reading at the moment...
More balanced, perhaps.
Possibly, yes. Well, just see what you think of this. This is Tobias Buck, the ex-Financial Times correspondent in Madrid, from his recently published book, After the Fall, Crisis, Recovery, and the Making of a New Spain. I read an excerpt from it last week. It really is a great book. And as a resident here, or even a visitor, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's absolutely up to the point. You know, it was published just a few months ago. So he refers to events that have happened this year, like, for example, the general election in April. And he goes on to say this. To be clear, life in Spain can be difficult if you have a foreign accent, a darker skin, or worship a different god. That was true before the arrival of the right-wing party Vox and remains true today. Racism exists in Spain and is, if anything, expressed with greater openness than in other European countries. Black football players, for example, are still greeted with monkey chants in some Spanish football arenas. Spaniards are, in my experience, also far more casual when it comes to voicing stereotypes and clichés about other nations than Northern Europeans. I've seen perfectly reasonable and educated people jokingly pull their eyes into slits when the conversation turns to China or Japan. I've heard seemingly liberal acquaintances explain that Jews are good with money and have a lot of influence. Words, expressions, and jokes that would strike the average Briton or American as unquestionably racist are thrown about without any awareness that they could hurt or insult. When Antoine Griezmann, a French striker playing for Atletico Madrid, a footballer, posted photos of himself in December 2017 as a blacked-up member of the Harlem Globetrotters, it caused shock headlines in the British press. And in Spain, no one seemed to understand what the fuss was about. I mean, contrast that with what's happened to Trudeau in Canada just recently. Tobias Buck goes on to say, I do not wish to belittle these words and gestures. Racism, anti-Semitism and hatred of Muslims exist everywhere, and Spain is certainly no exception. But despite the rise of Vox, it's striking how rarely these attitudes have translated into threats and violence. Hate crimes and physical attacks against foreigners are extremely rare. I've already written that I never personally encountered instances of verbal abuse or insults directed at migrants. That impression is broadly confirmed by the official data. According to Spain's Interior Ministry, the police recorded 416 racial hate crimes in all of the year 2016, which was a decline of 18% compared to the previous year. Cross-border comparisons are difficult because countries define and register such incidents differently. But Germany, for example, recorded more than 23 hate crimes every day, or 8,530 in total over the same period. According to official data, there were no fewer than 995 attacks on refugee centres alone in 2016. So that's all very interesting. And then he goes on to say that he thinks possibly the Spanish sympathy with migrants and people of different racial origins is rooted in the fact that the Spanish have a long tradition of immigrant, of being migrants themselves.
So there's an empathy there.
Yes, I mean, for example,
they know how hard it is.
Yeah, yeah. And for example, in the leaden years of the Franco dictatorship between the '50s and 1973, 2.75 million Spaniards moved to Germany.
2.75 million.
Yeah, wow. And I don't know if you've seen this film, which I would really like to see, and was unaware of it until I read this. It's called Vente a Alemania, Pepe. Come to Germany, Pepe. A 1971 film made by Spanish director. And it follows the journey of Pepe from a poor village in Aragon, from where he goes to Munich, to hopefully make his fortune, at least find work, and perhaps more importantly, get into bed with one of those famously uninhibited German girls. I mean, it is a comedy, but it's a bittersweet one, and apparently the bitterness breaks through undiluted. But Pepe arrives in a cold, busy Germany, clutching a cardboard suitcase. He struggles to understand and make himself understood. He pines for home. And that expression of dislocation and estrangement is one that countless Spaniards still carry today. And indeed, post-2008, a lot of Spaniards left. I mean, a lot of Spaniards left our village, didn't they?
Definitely, yes.
To go to London. A lot of them went to London.
And are people coming back?
I have no idea, honey. I don't know if people are coming back or not. But I just think that's interesting that possibly Spanish tolerance is about the fact that a lot of Spaniards have been on the other side and have had to. The other thing I would say is quite how welcome we feel.
Yes.
As foreigners. No one's.
In very early days, I think for the kids, it was quite hard at school, actually.
Kids are different.
Are they?
But
where does the kids' influence come from? It comes from the parents.
I think kids are prone to cruelty and bullying.
I don't think you can say that. But we're talking 20 years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, but when our kids were at school, and there was a lot of giddy, giddy, giddy stuff.
Yeah, but you go to a new school. If you were a young kid from Somerset and you went to school in Newcastle, for example, you would be the outsider.
I made that point, you disagree, but there's I think also a lot of it is the attitude of the press, what the press pick up on,
mm-hmm.
what it feeds through, what you see, what you want to hear, not you, but generally. And I think the whole press, particularly in the UK, just loves to feed off unpleasant stuff, racism, wokeism, whatever it is, and is a lot less political, is a lot more... so bored of Brexit, they're bringing another nice row of on the bus or something, that it will bring in the negative. And I think our friend Terry, he just turns off the news, and I can't help thinking that's a really good idea. What is the point in being miserable?
Let's not be miserable anymore. Yeah. Let's talk about squid. You've got some news about squid.
Talking about miserable.
Oh, you want to talk about miserable?
I do, actually.
Yes. Let's get more miserable.
No, earlier this year, the Samaritans came and talked to us, and they're looking for volunteers. And that's been successful. And the Samaritans in Spain are now, and have been for a while, up and running. So if you ever need to, just look up Samaritans in Spain if you need to talk to somebody totally anonymously. There's one thing the Samaritans could really do with it. I mean, it's people are trained, they're qualified. But one thing they could really do, if anybody can possibly donate, a telephone. They need mobile telephones with a plug for earphones. If you're upgrading and you're getting rid of your old phone, it would be much appreciated if you could donate it to them, because obviously the actual Samaritan has to have a separate phone to their own phone, so, and they put in the SIM card for the Samaritan. So if you look up Samaritans in Spain online and give them a call if you've got something to spare, that would be really, really nice. Thank you. That's a little call from them. What was I going to...
Squid.
All right, then, I'm just going to go on to the next
page. I'm excited about squid.
You'll see...
What can you possibly want to say about squid? I've just got this word squid written down here.
You ready?
I am. I'm all ears.
Squid and sanitary wipes.
Right.
Yum. A regular fishing day in the Mediterranean. Now, I don't know how long we've got. I could read a whole spiel on this.
We don't have a great deal of time. It's already 25 past. Goodness me. Where does the time go? Flies when you're enjoying yourself.
What I'm going to say is... Oh, I wish I had control of those buttons over there. What I'm going to say is...
Good luck. You come over here.
It looks... There's a lot of buttons. I can see. Yeah, we won't go into that now, dear. Oh, my God. If you use wet wipes, just stop. You don't need them. You can make your own. But... things have improved a lot in the Med, apparently, recently, but one of the main bones of contention, or plastics of contention, is sanitary wipes. Please stop using them. We got away without using them 10 years ago. We don't need them now. Just stop.
How do you make your own wet wipe?
You use cotton. And you use, or you use cotton wool, and you use some kind of moisturiser. Depends what you're going to use your wet wipe for. But basically,
they're tissue and spittle, something like that.
Yeah,
that's what my mum used to do.
Tell
yeah.
me all. Tissue, no, handkerchief and spittle.
Handkerchief and spittle.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yes.
No, I agree. I cannot understand wet wipes. Never bought a wet wipe. You get people who give them out free in garages and things like here. You want a free wet wipe? What? And it comes in a plastic. So, it comes in a plastic sachet.
Just stop. And they produce some ghastly thing in the sewage systems in big towns. And like they're called a fat blob or something. I don't even want to talk about it. But okay, so if you don't want sanitary wipes on your squid, stop using them. Over to you, dear.
Thank you, my love.
Enjoy your breakfast.
I just wanted to say one thing before we stop for a break. On October the 31st is Halloween, and apparently a thing called, let me just see what I can, Brexit. Yes, Brexit, that's right.
Yeah.
But what's happening, actually, is there's a festival, which might just be a Halloween with a breakfast. It's called Brexit and Zay, and it's being held in Holland on the North Dutch coast. And it's about waving goodbye to Britain. It's called Brexit and Zay. And if Brexit doesn't happen on the 31st of October, I'm not quite sure whether this festival will go on. I'm sure it probably will. But I just like the idea of a whole load of Europeans, and probably Brits as well, congregating almost within sight of the island, waving goodbye. After these messages, the next in our series for autumn, Iberian Caminos.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbolista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Last week on Iberian Caminos, we sampled the enchantment of an Asturian September, a world of rushing streams and rivers, deciduous forests, orchards groaning under the weight of pears and cider apples, and hedgerows of hazel, bramble and cow parsley. September the 8th is Asturia Day, a big fiesta, no less, when thousands of locals return to their pueblos, when traditional dress is worn and the gaita is played, when sheep are barbecued, cider is drunk and flags are flown, the banner of España with the gold cross of the Asturias on precarious 20-metre poles of eucalyptus or from cairns on distant hillsides. Appropriately, that day we found ourselves lunching in the town of Cangas de Onís, the original capital of the Asturias. Now, it's hard to find a travelogue of the Asturias that doesn't rave about its hearty cuisine. Food writers go on about this. Food writers. What is this genre of people who make their living from long lunches, getting fed and paid all at once? And how important to tourists is food anyway? Well, apparently it's of essential importance, otherwise food writers would be on their bikes looking for a real job. So how does their charmed existence actually work? if you're a food writer expecting a free meal, haven't you given the game away? I mean, if they believe you when you call Heston Blumenthal's restaurant, whatever it's called, the Fat Duck or something, and say, hello, I'm a food writer writing for Country Life, the restaurant will either say, go away, I don't believe you, or it pulls out the stops and your subsequent review may not be a fair reflection of what the average punter experiences. Then again, if you're incognito, undercover, surely you wind up paying for your own meal. It's a bit of a conundrum, really. Talking of food, though, Asturias is renowned for its cuisine, especially its cheese, with a greater concentration of individual cheeses per square kilometre than even France, or something. The most famous, the one that cheese lovers become slightly hysterical over, is Queso Cabrales, a blue fermentation that attains maturity in a cave. Crumbly or moist, its innards resemble an igneous rock in whose veins hum a penicillin-flavoured ecosystem of microbes, which, having tanged off the roof of your mouth, direct themselves to your gut. To join previous helpings of faves con almejas, a potaje of fat white beans and clams, and el plato más típico de Asturias is called fabada asturiana, which are more fat white beans swimming in oil and paprika with pig's cheek and chorizo, I think, bobbing out of a pen. It's not really your thing, but you did try it one time, didn't you?
I did. I've made some for supper last night, actually, but you didn't. You were like,
oh, you've still got it waiting for us when we get home.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Mm. What is a fabada asturiana?
It's the no dish better represents Asturias than this slow-simmered pot of pork and beans. Born, this is, sounds like my sister Janie's idea of heaven. Born sometime in the late 19th century, it forms a vital part of Spain's cocido class, the slow-simmered stews found in every region around the country. As the name suggests, the star of the dish is the fabe, the large creamy white bean that swells with the flavour of the braising liquid. Like a good plate of pasta, the integrity of the bean is everything. It should be toothsome, creamy and fully intact. Thinking about it, actually, halfway through this, do you remember seeing that sack of dried beans? A tiny, weeny little sack of dried beans. It was €11.
Yes.
About 2 kilos. I think they're very expensive.
You get fabada asturiana start kits, which are the beans and the three sorts of chorizo, the morcilla and the chorizo and something else.
Yes.
In a sort of cellophane packet. There you go.
But those beans look like, oof, yeah, you wouldn't want to undercook them.
I actually like the beans.
Yeah, I do.
They don't like me very much.
Fabada is an expression of Spain's deep dedication to pork. But Holy Trinity comes with its own name, compango, the mix of heavily smoked chorizo, blood sausage and a pork belly that gives fabada its bulk, aroma and colour. The red tide, that shiny layer of red resting on top of the stew, is a mixture of fat and smoked paprika leached from the slow-simmered cuts of pork. Classy restaurants will defat the stew to keep the flavours light and clean, but the fabada is meant to keep you full, not thin. And actually, I agree. You know, it feeds you. It does feed you.
Particularly good winter food.
Yeah, it's really nice. Actually, I like it.
The comfort. I mean, it does have an unfortunate inflationary effect, and the preponderance of beans in these hearty indigenous foods. I was only able to partially offset at a market in the aforementioned Cangas de Onís, a town so friendly the Chinese in the Super Asia Emporium were smiling. In the traditional open-air market, stalls selling madrillas, clogs with zero sex appeal. I mean, show me a clog with sex appeal. Asturian madrillas have four stubby rubber-capped trotters on each sole that give not only grip but elevation. So you put them on over your slippers of a wet evening to collect the logs or visit the dunny, I'm not sure. And they were also at this market in Cangas de Onís.
Keep you out in the mud, actually, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. They're sort of like emergency, I must go outside.
Crocs
shoes.
Yeah, wooden Crocs.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And also in this market, there were bakeries for the exceptionally hungry, offering cut loaves with chorizos inserted into them. An Asturian toad in the hole. I mean, there were endless cheese stalls proffering endless varieties of more cheese, and sweet shops selling step-sized slabs of artisan chocolate. Now, among these stout foods, I found a stall lovingly laden with cellophane packets of herbs and dried flowers, each categorised and charismatically labelled. And they were basically infusiones. They were basically teas. And,
yes.
And you've got some examples of the mixes that they had for sale.
Yeah, you're quite taken by this tea, weren't you? There's one called El Camino de Oxigeno, Oxygen, which improves your circulation. Riego, I suppose that's something to do with your kidneys. And varices, your veins.
Mm-hmm.
And the contents of which are the part of the infusion mix is espino blanco, castaño de Indian chestnut, sanguinaria, I don't know what that is, ginkgo biloba, we know what that is, and ortiga, which is nettle. And that's going to help your circulation and varicose veins. There's quite a few of these, actually, and they are good. I mean, it's like we were talking about Ellie last week and the infusion she makes, but these are actually to drink and quite comforting. You tried one, though, didn't you?
We bought two, actually, yes.
Got two pretty quick.
There was one that I couldn't walk by, bearing in mind the Favada Asturiana. And it was particularly appropriate for me because the title was El Molino Incansable, which translates somewhat obliquely as the tireless miller. I knew it was for me.
The tireless miller,
yeah. But I knew it was for me because it had the word gas after El Molino Incansable. And it's a combination of fennel, milk, mint, thyme, basil and oregano. And it was soothing without being entirely remedial. But even now, in moments of discomfort, I do spare a thought for the old tireless miller down there.
Very good.
Yeah, now, if cheese has a rival in the pantheon of Asturian comestibles, it would have to be cider. Now, I'm not a native to Somerset, but I did live there for over 20 years, where in Wurzel country, cider is also known as glider, because it imbues you with a sense of weightlessness. So I've drunk enough cider to know that if your first pint tastes insipidly underwhelming or just plain horrible, keep going. Your taste buds, if they're not anaesthetized by then, they will at least adapt. So let me take you briefly, let's go back to Bristol briefly, to the Coronation Tap, a draft cider pub, where this sensory acclimatization to cider was abridged with the addition of a schooner of rum and black currant into your pint. I mean, it tasted good, and the effect after three of them, and it was known, this cocktail was known as Red Eye, was nothing less than hallucinatory. Do you not remember Red Eye?
I don't think I ever had one, to be honest. Oh. Why would I do that to myself?
Well, it would be sociable, darling. Mm. I mean, drinking cider, though, in the Asturias is rather different. You see, it doesn't appear to be something you can do on your own. You need a skilled waiter to pour a splash of this otherwise unpalatably dry beverage into a glass from a great height. And this oxygenation is what wakes up the cider, gives it life. So you drink off a mouthful as soon as your glass has been slapped down, and then, oddly, you tip the rest on the floor. And something about returning it to the earth.
Oh, I think that's the sedimenty bit at the bottom.
Well, you can. I mean, the first ones I was drinking a lot, and then I noticed people tipping out the last bit on the floor.
Yeah.
Very
organic.
But then you have to wait for your waiter to administer another shot, unless you get impatient and have a go yourself, which I did, and that was messy and undignified. But it is worth waiting for the artiste, because there's something quite compelling in watching a waiter pour a shot of cider. It's as though he's about to execute a quietly violent martial art. The camarero in the sideria enters the zone, momentarily transcending the mayhem of expectant inebriants around him. An in-breath, the stance, feet planted apart, straight back, bottle high in one hand, glass in the other, other arms at full extension to gain as much aerating distance as possible. But it's the gaze, unblinking, into the middle distance that verges on trance, because the man pouring the cider doesn't apparently need to look at what he's doing. Neither bottle nor the arc of the liquid in trajectory, nor the glass. He somehow just senses it. In the jaleo of the San Mateo Festival in Oviedo, I watched a camarero performing this maneuver, and it is a performance, for a table at the bar next to ours. He made 7 consecutive perfect pours, a 2-meter trajectory of acidic green liquid flowing from bottle to glass, and the pavement beneath him remained dry. I've actually been thinking I might explore the relationship cider drinkers have with blackbirds, because regardless of the variance in their manner of drinking cider, like Somerset, Asturias too has a poem which features a blackbird in an apple tree. And the Somerset verse goes like this. Yeah, go on, babes. Can you
no,
remember?
No, that's the first.
Where be?
Where be yes, the blackbird?
Not for. It is, I know where that blackbird be. I know where he's too. He be up in an apple tree. That's where he be too. He sees me. Me sees he. Oh, what a great big bird he be. I know where that blackbird be. I know where he's too. And the Asturian poem is briefer and more to the point. Because it dates from ancient Celtic days, it is actually anonymous, and it translates like this. Sang a blackbird in an apple tree, he whose cider does not drink, a true Asturian cannot be.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbolista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Our first guest today is Eric Hersey. He's from A Touch of Spain, and he joins us from Barcelona. Eric, good morning, and welcome home with the Hogs.
Good morning.
Good morning, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing well today. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, we're good. Good. Thank you very much. We've got a nice bit of cloud here, which we haven't had for a while. We're very happy.
What's the weather like in Barcelona, Eric?
Right now it's actually sunny, a little bit overcast, but mostly sunny. It's nice.
And not heinously hot.
No, it's a beautiful day.
Good, man. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, Eric, have you lived in Barcelona since you arrived in Spain, or have you always been there?
No, I arrived in Spain in 2001, and actually lived my first 3 years, I lived in Malaga.
Oh, okay. Not far from where we are now. And then you moved to Barcelona to
and I moved to Barcelona. I met a girl from Barcelona, and that, you know, kind of
did it for you.
Yeah, that's kind of all she wrote, you know.
Excellent. And so you set up the company, the Spanish Touch.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the Spanish Touch.
Well, the Spanish Touch was born out of... Well, when I first came to Spain, I actually wasn't planning on staying in Spain. I was actually on my way to Prague. But I stopped in Spain for a couple of weeks to visit some friends down in Malaga, and I just fell in love with Spain completely. I mean, the people, the culture, the history, everything. And I haven't made it to Prague yet.
you still haven't been.
I'm working on it.
You're working on it.
But so, I did. I fell in love with Spain completely, and I was going back, and I went back to the States.
So you're actually originally from the States?
I am actually originally from the States. Yeah.
Okay.
And so I went back to the States, and I was talking to people about these fantastic experiences I had had in Spain, and everybody that had been to Spain, they didn't know anything about this, and I thought this is Spain. This is what I love about it. And so I came up with this idea for a tour company that gets people in touch with Spain, with the Spain that I knew, that
yes.
That I had fallen in love with.
Away from the sunbed and the swimming pool.
Exactly. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's, you know, no. I lived on the Costa del Sol for years. It's a beautiful place. But if you want to get away from that and you want to do more culture. You want to get involved with the people in the small town.
Eric, was there a moment that delayed indefinitely your progress to Prague? And can you put your finger on that moment? It was when you decided you were going to stay here. Your fiancé apart.
Yeah, I was going to say, aside from that. No, you know what? I think there was a time I was sitting at a small cafe and talking with a couple of friends. I guess I'd been living in Spain for maybe a month and a half. And I just kind of realized that this was a beautiful place to live. And I just enjoyed what was happening. And I thought, well, why would I go somewhere else right now?
And you felt at home?
I did. You know, I took Spanish in school, which was totally useless when I actually got to Spain.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It was, you know, it's not, I tell people all the time, you know, I learned Spanish in Malaga, which is kind of like going to Alabama to learn English.
yeah, I get it.
It is.
The Andalus accent, you mean?
Yeah, the Andalus accent is wonderful. I love it.
Have you kept your Andalus accent now in Barcelona?
I have this really weird accent because it's American Andalus Catalan.
Yes, that does sound like a mix.
And I did eventually, after about a month and a half, when I decided to stay in Spain, I did actually sign up for an English Spanish academy, and it was a wonderful place. There were 40 students. There was me, a girl from Denmark, and 38 Germans.
Yeah.
And as I didn't speak German, I thought, well, maybe I should learn Spanish. So,
yeah, that is funny though, the accent thing, because our kids grew up here speaking Andalus, and I've learned Spanish that is Andalus, and then actually two of our kids went to Barcelona. They both lived in Barcelona for a while and became acutely aware of their Cateto accents and made a conscious attempt to change. Because they felt, I think, in some way judged.
Well, your cousin had a little word, didn't she? Like, hey, guys, you cannot talk like
you
that
have
here.
To lose that.
There's no way. Yeah. You won't go far. I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
I haven't had that, really. But I've always said, you know, accents is a thing that you have. I mean, my grandmother's been living in the U.S. for 76 years.
Yeah.
And she's still got a British accent. She'll deny it. But she still has a British accent.
And is she British?
She's British by birth, yeah. She grew up, she was born and raised in London.
Ah, okay.
And she didn't leave the UK until she was 23.
But she still, but she obviously doesn't want to. What are we talking about, Eric? Well, I want to talk about the hang on,
we're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there. it's going to suddenly be on the hour. Tell us about your tour. Please, to the saffron fields. I've always wanted to go myself and always seem to time it wrong.
Well, timing is probably the most difficult thing because saffron is, the timing is really...
it's crucial.
Well, is now. In the saffron field, they only bloom 2 to 3 weeks a year.
2 to 3 weeks a year. Uh-huh.
Maximum.
This could explain it.
When is that?
So, it's... Depending on the year, it can start as early as the 3rd or 4th of October, or this year it's actually going to be quite late. It'll probably start next week.
Mm-hmm.
This week they're still not doing the harvesting. You know, we talk about saffron being the most expensive spice in the world, and it is. I mean, you're talking...
Red gold.
It's red gold. I mean, it's anywhere from 3 to 9 euros a gram.
Wow.
All right, now gold is a little more expensive. It's like 43 euros a gram, but...
As a herb.
But it's, exactly. This is a spice. Yeah.
So can we explain to people, so saffron actually is the stamens, correct, of a crocus,
yes.
Which only blooms 2 or 3 weeks a year.
Right, it's the crocus sativus. It's a specific...
Sativus, okay.
Variety, and it only blooms... 2 to 3 weeks a year, and here's the second problem. A saffron bulb in the same soil without moving has an expected quality of life of 2 to 4 years.
Oh, so it doesn't self-propagate? It doesn't divide?
No.
And
It does, but the problem is saffron is so intensive, it destroys the soil. It destroys where it's in.
Really?
In 4 years. Now, you can get, like, for example, Iran produces 90% of the saffron in the world. And they will have their saffron fields, they will be used for 10 to 12 years. They will run the saffron plant dry. But it's much like oak barrels and wine. After the first couple of years, you're not really getting very much. And you can still use it. But the Spanish saffron in La Mancha, which is where the festival is, they use the saffron. They use the same field for 2 to 4 years.
Yeah. And then it's kind of exhausted, is it?
Then it's exhausted. And here's the other part of that. It's so exhausted that it takes a minimum of 20 years.
No.
To be able to use that same field for saffron again. You can use the field for whatever you want afterwards. They use it a lot for alfalfa or barley, but you can use it for whatever you want, but you can't use it for saffron for 20 to 25 years.
So what is it that the saffron's taking?
It takes all the minerals. I mean, it's such an intensive, it sucks all the nutrients that it needs
into its plant. From a tiny little flower?
This tiny little flower that, you know, each flower has three stems, and each stem, it sucks all this nutrient out. And after 4 years, essentially, it'll still produce flowers for another 6-7 years.
So Crocus sativus, how much water demand does it have? How thirsty is it?
Not thirsty at all. If you're going to plant it at home, they basically are like, yeah, plant it and then kind of leave it alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's not a lot of water in La Mancha.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's very hot in the summer. It's very cold at night and in the winter. There's not a lot of rain in La Mancha.
So what originated this crocus to grow in La Mancha, the production of saffron? Is it a Moorish thing?
At the very least, it's yes. The Moors were the ones that really installed it in La Mancha. They brought it in from the Orient. Nobody's quite actually sure where saffron came from, but the Moors are definitely the ones that brought it to Spain and established it in La Mancha in the 6th or 7th century.
Eric, can I just ask you, we've got this very delicate plant which sucks everything dry, which actually is only in flower 2 to 3 weeks of the year. How on earth do you organise a tour to see these? They must be quite tricky to organise.
This sounds like a nightmare of schedule.
Get your flights, how do you do it?
Yeah, it's a logistical nightmare, but you know ahead of time when you can do it. It changes every year. It changes slightly every year.
Right.
But it's always going to be the end of October.
Okay. So
you're always going to have the last 2 weeks of October, the last week of October, the first week of November, almost always.
Okay.
You're going to have it at that time.
So and I'm coming on. We've got 2 minutes. So I'm coming on your tour. I'm booked in. What are we going to do?
Okay. On our tour, one of the things we do, and this is where the Spanish touch does its thing.
Yeah.
We bring you in touch with the producers. Okay.
Perfect.
In order to actually, we actually take you literally out into the field where you can help pick these flowers. And then there's three parts to the saffron process, right? So you pick them, then you have to de-stem them.
You pick the whole flower?
You pick the flower.
Yes.
And then you take it, you have to keep it in a dry place, and you take it and then you de-stem it. They call it the monda. Okay, and then after the Monday, they dry it and package it.
Okay,
it all has to be done at a specific time. So, for example, you have to pick it in the morning.
Oh, right.
Because
so
if it's out in the sun all day, the flowers dry up, and then you lose it. So, what we do is we literally take you out. This is a community-based event. Festival, you know, everybody in the community comes out and does this and helps with they hire extra labor if they need to, but the community comes out. These are family-run businesses. We go in with the family, people that have been doing this for generations, and they show you how to do it and help you with it, and they'll take you through it step by step. And then afterwards, you go to the festival, the actual festival of Azafrán, where they have folk dancing, and they have they actually activate one of the 16th-century windmills to grind some flour.
Wow, wicked. They still operate.
I mean, it's a fantastic...
One of those old pot-bellied Don Quixote windmills.
Exactly. One of the giants. And, you know, they do that. We take you into the culture. We go beyond just showing you what it is. So that you actually feel like you're a part of it and you can really get your hands
dirty.
Eric, it's been brilliant, and that is super tempting, but unfortunately we're out of time. Very quickly, how do we make contact with
you? Contact us,
Touch of Spain.
It's quite easy. You send us an email to info@thespanishtouch. Our website is thespanishtouch.com. On that website, we have you can contact us via WhatsApp. You can contact us through email. You can give us a call.
Superb. Fantastic, Eric. Thank you. And we're going to call you again because that was really good
to talk
to you.
Yeah, we'd really like to talk to you. Yeah,
yes.
And see how it all went. Next tour, I'm coming. Yeah.
Excellent. Fantastic.
I love that part of the world. Brilliant, man. Have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
Well. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Eric Hersey from Spanish Touch. Coming up in the next hour, Arbalistas, Palms, Trees and Gardens, and Richard Bell Young, a living, breathing encyclopedia of the world of wine. We'll see you after the news.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. Kit Hogg and Penny. At home. With the Hogs. With the Hogs. With the Hogs.
We plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the land, but it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. He sends the snow in winter, the warmth to swell the grain, the breezes and the sunshine and soft, refreshing rain.
Soft, refreshing rain. Yes, I think we've got some soft, refreshing rain on the way next week. According to your brother, Paul Jewson, who is listening to us in Oxford today. Hi, Paul. Very good morning to you. And thanks for keeping us in touch with the weather. Let's hope we do get some soft, refreshing rain.
No doubt it's on its way.
End this heinous drought.
Morning, Paul. I wish he'd come and talk to us on the radio, you know. My brother. He'd be so good. He'd be good at advice.
What would he talk to us about?
Well, OCD. But the problem is...
He's too OCD.
He's OCD to come on the radio. Paul, come back.
Right. Talking of OCD, I just thought I'd run this by you. This is from a listener in the States who said that he thought of us the other day because he saw a video of a 12-meter chainsaw hanging from a helicopter trimming trees by power lines. Was intense and looked about as dangerous as anything on earth. Bunch of huge spinning blades swinging wildly around giant trees. Looked hideous and yet somehow high voltage watchable. I love that.
Well, it's like watching tree surgery
in the US.
That is. Like watching the fire planes and the helicopters here, who are phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Yes, it's compelling, isn't it?
It's utterly compelling, particularly if you... I'll never forget, I know I've said this before, just seeing one of these big water-carrying planes fly under some pylons, under them, right in front of me.
Under the power lines.
Anyway, to vetiver.
Yes, this is less dramatic, isn't it? It's a grass with a root system... So expansive, so grippy, that it's revolutionising the way we think about flood zones and soil erosion.
Well, if you live in Murcia in particular, this might be of interest to you. This is a plant called vetiver. Now, we actually planted some at our land.
Can you spell that, Bob?
V-E-T-I-V-E-R.
Okay.
There's a lot of information about it online. Some of it's quite scrambled, so I'll try and unscramble it if I possibly can. Now, the Latin name for it is Chrysopogon zizanoides. You might just want to stick to vetiver. It's a native to India. and it's being used and has has been used in India for years for erosion control. Now, just to say now that the roots can reach from 2 to 10 meters. They are phenomenal growing. So this vetiver plant is non-invasive. It cannot reproduce itself. It has to be made into slips and then replanted, like divided.
So it doesn't flower, it doesn't seed.
It doesn't flower. No, that's the one disadvantage of it. Actually, it doesn't have flowers. It doesn't. It's a very good animal fodder. Mm-hmm. It can be clipped like a hedge. But the roots are the key to it. So these roots in India are used for perfume. They're used for pest control. They're used primarily for stabilizing banks. And so if you have a... I'll read something about it in a minute. So that this, I'll just do a rough thing about it because it's a really interesting plant. Also, the roots can be used for matting, for blinds, because they have this sort of natural insecticide within them. It really, really helps to keep insects away naturally. So, they fix topsoil. Let me have a look at this. I'm going to read it to here.
They fix topsoil because of their extraordinary root system. You said they had roots 10 metres long.
Yes.
I mean, that's not necessarily 10 metres down toward the Earth's core, is it?
It is.
It's a spread.
If you look online, I mean, obviously I can't show you online, but I'm going to read some of this because it's going to be slightly more succinct than me. The vetiver system is a system of soil and water conservation whose main component is the use of the plant in hedgerows. Is promoted by an international network, so it's recognised throughout the world. And it's used in more than 100 countries for soil and water conservation, infrastructure stabilisation, pollution control, wastewater treatment, mitigation, rehabilitation, etc., etc., like sediment control, prevention of storm damage and other environmental protection applications. Some people use it instead of building a wall. If you've got time, then you can. It's a very good, cheap way of building a wall. I might incidentally say that it's also very good as a screen. It can reaches up to 2 meters in height, so it's a very good green screen. It's not like a hedgerow in that you're going to stop people getting through it, but it's a good visual screen. Now, the plant is the main component, this plant, the vetiver, is the main component in bioengineering and conservation applications. It can be used in the tropics and semi-tropics, areas that have a Mediterranean climate where the hot summers and winters are reasonably temperate. So when vetiver is planted as a hedgerow across a slope, it forms a dense vegetative barrier that slows and spreads rainfall or runoff. So I think a lot of flooding occurs because if you imagine that great drop of rain on a huge tarmac surface, where's the water going to go? It's just going to run off.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're looking out here, you've got a huge tarmac surface here. If it's broken up with plants, they absorb it and they actually change the whole ground level structure. Combined with a deep and strong root system, a wide range of pH tolerance from about pH 3 to pH 11, a high tolerance to most heavy metals, and an ability to remove from soil and water large quantities of nitrates, it cleans water, phosphates and farm chemicals, what's not to like? We have a call, I see.
We do have a caller. Paul is on the line. Good morning, Paul. Well, good afternoon, technically.
I'm sorry to have interrupted your young lady, but...
That's not a problem.
I haven't stopped singing All Things Bright and Beautiful.
Oh, it's you again. Hello.
You love that, don't you, Paul? Does it remind you of school?
It did, when we had assemblies.
Yeah.
And I'm driving along the road singing All things bright and blue.
Carry on then, come on.
Actually, no, that's not what we played. We didn't play All Things Bright and Beautiful.
No, we didn't.
No, but that was one of them.
Yeah. We'll do All Things Bright and Beautiful. But we like the one we played. Because it is about growing things.
No, that's correct.
Yeah.
But they don't have it anymore, assemblies, which is a poor thing. But anyway, magic programme, most enjoyable.
Thank you for listening. Yeah. Where are you?
I'm up in Cagliostro, up in the Costa Blanca.
Tremendous. Well, very nice to hear from you, Paul. Have a great weekend. And carrying on ploughing the fields and scattering. Singing along. See you, mate.
Okay. I don't know how I'm doing for time here. Is this boring, hon? Shall I carry on?
It's becoming marginally less interesting.
Try and keep concentrating.
I am listening. Yes.
Because, okay.
We do have a bit of a busy agenda.
I know we have. So,
what were we talking about?
Don't believe this.
This exciting grass from India.
You just... okay, this might get it more excited. It's got stiff and erect stems.
Oh, right.
Which can stand... I thought that would wake you up. Which can stand up to relatively deep water flow. New shoots develop from the underground crown, making it resistant to fire, frost, traffic and heavy grazing pressure. Basically, if you're worried about your ground moving or about the soil moving, or you're trying to re-establish your soil and your earth, we lost our topsoil, for example, this could be the plant for you. There's about 80 centimetres per stem, and I really suggest you give it a go. Easy to do as well.
Goodness me, the phone lines are burning hot.
How exciting.
I'm on this exciting subject. No one's called us for weeks. Hello,
yes,
good morning.
I told you people. Well,
good morning. It is getting a bit boring. But
we got a complaint.
Thank you, dear.
It's too boring.
Oh, I'm so sorry, but only your sister could say that. Listen, I wanted to call in about the Samaritans. You gave out a number, which is for the main line, when you were asking for donations for any mobile phones.
Yeah.
It would be better if you could call, if you do have a mobile phone spare that can take headphones, if you could call Jilly Hodges, who organises the Andalusia branch, which is where we need them.
Yeah.
Can I give her number?
Yeah, quickly, Jenny. I'm in the in mid-flow here. Carry on.
I'm so sorry.
No, I think you've nearly finished, actually. But anyway, yeah,
okay.
Let's have Jilly Hodges' number from the Samaritans.
You can WhatsApp or call her on 0044.
Yeah.
770. That's 370.
Yeah.
368.
Okay, so that's to donate a mobile phone to the Samaritans. You call Jilly Hodges. She's on 0044 000 368 368.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah,
good
luck with that, Janie. Yeah, thanks. Nice to hear
great
from you.
Great show.
Thank you, darling. Bye bye.
Talking of harvesting, now is the time of the algarobos. If you have an algaroba, do you realise that one very small sack of algaroba now will reach 12 euros in the cooperativa? That's a lot.
A
small sack of carob beans.
I thought that was a 100-kilo sack.
No. Jose was telling me... Price is really up.
Right.
And that's why Jose was very glad it's a holiday on Monday. He's the chap that works for us. Because he's going to go out with his mules and he's going to collect algarobo.
In his long pole. And he will stand at the base and put the nets out. And he'll stand at the base of the algarobo tree, which is a carob. And hit it, and all those pods will drop off.
Yeah, good money. And then it's olive harvest as well, and chestnut.
Lots going on. I think it's a bit early for olives, though. I don't think olives come till a bit later. But it is harvest time. Now, moving on. Next week, we're going to be looking at autumn colour and some of the forests that you can visit where you can enjoy autumn colour. Spain, not synonymous, certainly the south of Spain, not synonymous with autumn colour, but there are glorious forests in the north, and we'll be outlining some of those next week. Meanwhile, we're going to look at a tree of the day, and it is none other than that paragon of watery grace, the willow, Salix alba, or in the filigree curtain of its classic weeping form, Salix babylonica. It's a shade-giving tree, and is often subjugated in preference to the false pepper here in the south, pimienta falsa, which is a native of Brazil. But the weeping willow is worth giving a go. And what's great about it is that it's ludicrously easy to propagate. What do I mean by propagate? You cut a stem, you pop it in wet ground, and that's it. Ideally, keep it wet.
Where do you think we live?
The roots. No, but you get to keep it watered, my darling.
Pop it in the
ground. You get. Yeah. I mean, trying to get trees to grow here is difficult.
No, you start with a pot. You know, you're not going to put it in the ground. You would start with a pot.
Okay, right? Yeah, definitely. That's a good idea.
Yes, I watched Gardener's World last night. I know about these things.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, it depends on the ground. Ground can be contained in a pot or it can be contained in a raised bed, but it has to be obviously sympathetic ground because the roots and the suckers spread widely and make a beeline for water. Water is key here. And of course, that is a talent that can cause havoc when a willow explores the tiniest leaks in pipes and sewers and then infiltrates, expands and clogs. So don't plant too close to your house. But by a riverbank, for example, if you happen to live near a riverbank, again, like the vetiver grass, willow's mass of tangled roots prevents erosion and provides shelter for wildlife. Did you know there are 450 species of willow? Spread across Europe. And the one that is absolutely the classic one is Salix babylonica, the weeping willow. Got its name from a mistranslation of Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung up our harps. Boney M plagiarised that psalm, yes. Yeah. I wonder if... whoever wrote the psalm took them to court. Probably they didn't. The tree in question was probably the Euphrates poplar and not actually a willow, but the association between drooping willows and sorrow struck. And throughout Europe, the practice of wearing a wreath or a hat made from willow to signify mourning lasted for several centuries in the Middle Ages, at least in popular song. All around my hat, I will wear the willow. Was it the willow?
Yeah.
Yes, that song just came into my head. And superstition has created a link between willow and sadness, but it's also got a connection with the relief of physical pain that is based on good chemistry. In ancient Egypt, the Egyptians were already using willow as to treat fever and headaches. And from about 400 BC, Hippocrates prescribed willow bark for rheumatism. And willow's been used against fever. It's been used as a popular cure for toothache.
It was the portent to aspirin.
And yes, that's right. Yeah, because it contains a chemical called salicin, which can be converted into our bodies to substances that have analgesic and fever-reducing effects. So that is the weeping willow. Very briefly, actually, because we've got rather a treat coming up for you. All that you wanted to know about wine, but were afraid to ask, with the maestro, Richard Bell Young, coming up after these messages.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998.
On its own.
Find out more at spaintree.com. At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Now, a very vendimia here within the kitchen at Home with the Hogs, a sommelier of the soul with an encyclopedic knowledge of wine from Vino Market in San Enrique de Guadiaro. We're a very warm welcome to Richard Bell Young. Richard, thank you so much for coming in. It's so nice to see you.
Absolute pleasure. It's good to be back.
And I would like to say that if... during the course of our conversation, you want to get involved, please do call us, 952-784-1000. We'd love to hear from you. We're talking all about wine here. Now, Richard, along with Christendom, symphony music and the rule of law, wine and its heritage is something quintessentially, indigenously European. And just briefly, what are the great wine areas of Europe?
Well, first of all, the history and culture of wine goes back millennia. So actually, although in sort of recent centuries, the European influence is by far the greatest throughout the world. Certainly,
did wine originate in Europe?
I think it probably originated in different parts of the world, pretty much at the same time, by quirks of luck, I suppose, by crushing grapes. Grapes was a delicacy of the gods in Greek mythology, and it's sweet and nice to eat. And then people would squeeze it, and juice would come out, and that led to a natural fermentation with yeast in the grape itself that turned it to alcohol.
So as long as there was grapes, there was a possibility of wine.
Yeah, and you can make wine from without grapes, but that's a different world.
Oh, really?
But to answer your question,
you can potato wine, can't you?
You can have
like
fruit
that.
Wine. You can have all kinds
of
wine.
Of course,
but you can make a form of wine from the way that beer's made. But the point is that's how it all started. And, you know, the word, a lot of people will understand and know of the grape Syrah or Shiraz. Well, there's a town in Iran called Shiraz, and there's a legend that says that that's in the town where wine started. But I think the Romans did a huge part in Europe to establish in more modern era that the dominance of wines, you know, being made in Europe. And, you know, of the top 15, I'm a little bit prepared, of the top 15 in 2018 producers of wine, seven were in Europe. And the top three are Europe. So you've got Italy, France, and Spain. In terms of volume of producing wine, they're the top three out of 15. You've got Greece, and you've as well also in Europe, but you have Argentina, Australia, South Africa, which are the New World wines. But it's interesting that of the three top ones, they're in Europe, and they are the traditional wine-making areas.
Tremendous. So
not New
Europe,
World.
Europe is holding its own.
Ah, it's tremendous. And Spain is probably number two to France, in not so much in production, but in terms of quality and sales and demand.
Now, of course, all over Europe is the harvest of the grape right now. Vendimia here in Spain, the Vendage, of course, in France. And can you picture the owner of the vines pacing the rows, feeling the random grapes to see exactly when the harvest might begin? I mean, this obviously is a critical moment, pregnant with importance. And what are the factors that are going through his mind at the moment?
Oh, my goodness. You're so right, Kit. It's the highest stress level period in the winemaking process in a calendar year.
That timing.
Ah, such subtle variance in weather, wind, cold, heat, altitude, even sort of like a mist can affect not just the quality, not just of the grape itself, but the decision to be taken. It is such an important pinpoint of stress to get it right. And it's rarely got right. It's a question of compromise. So a decision will be taken, people will be in readiness, and basically from starting to finish, it'll take a couple of weeks, 10 days, to actually do the picking process, which is the first part of the process of the winemaking.
How will this unusually hot summer have affected the ripening process of the grapes? Is it an earlier vendimia than usual?
Yeah, the hotter it is, as the grape ripens or is encouraged to ripen. There's a good point to make, actually, and that is that the winemakers will be very skillful in delegating to their trusted workers to cut away foliage, leaves, in order for the grapes, the bunches, to actually start to get more sun if it's warming up.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, it'll speed up the date. It'll bring the date forward because the grape will ripen quicker with the sun. It's normal. If it's colder, it'll take longer. If it's wet, that's a big problem. Fungus can grow within a few days if it's too wet. So there's all kinds of issues.
Are vines ever irrigated during the growing process, during the summer?
That is really a good question. And the best way to answer it is no. And the reason for that is because the harder a vine has to work to find moisture and minerals, the better the fruit.
Does that mean that it can never be too hot or too dry?
Oh, no. There are extremes on both spectrums. And, you know, there may be some kind of irrigation in terms of during the course of the year, in the midsummer, early summer, etc. But the principle is that, you know, sandy soils, poor arable land, rocky land is great for vines.
Okay. Now, I suppose really the point I'm driving at is climate change and how that might change the grape growing areas.
Is it a threat? Well, it'll stop. I mean, long term, it's going to probably, if the effect of climate change is to increase the temperature, not decrease it in the world, then if you look, there are on Google, you can actually find geographic maps of the world that show you over the period of the last, today, going back, say, 1,000 years, showing you where the best geographically, you know, the best areas in the world were. And it's pretty much just north and south of the equator. And you'll see a band, right, you know, of where the wines are made. But I think to answer your question, it's probably going, if it heats up long term, it'll start to bring forward the usual dates for harvest in
Europe. It won't take areas out of production, in your opinion?
No, well,
extremely,
I
like southern areas, like Valdebenas, for
example. If the world increases in temperature by 10 degrees, none of us will be here.
Yes.
You know? But, I mean, I think that in the context of where I think your question is going, that I think it's going to probably bring it in earlier. And that could be a very good thing for Spain, actually, because their dominant grape is Tempranillo. And the Tempranillo, which, by the way, comes in many nicknames, there's about 40 nicknames, but it's Tempranillo, it's called Tempranillo for a very good reason, and that is that it's relatively an early ripening grape. That's why it's Temprano, it's early. And so that would probably produce a quicker, sooner harvest for Spain.
Mm.
But I, you know, it won't be in my lifetime.
Okay, well, yes, all right. Let's tell us something about the process now of making the wine. And how does a humble grape, briefly, I know, because this is a long process, how does a humble grape become part of the dance on the tongue?
You see how long we've got, Richard. That
well, I've already been warned by
that. That is
too.
A fine wine.
I've got about lots 10 of minutes. On the first phase, anyway. Okay, well, look, there are basically five or six steps of
tell us.
Yeah, I mean, you get a point where the grape is starting to show itself, the fruit, and that will start to cause some interest and care and maintenance. And then the real flurry starts midsummer, end summer, when in Spain in particular, when, you know, they're looking to see how the production is going in terms of how much fruit there is on the vines. How the bunches are. The winemaker, the oenologist, will be constantly taking samples, checking, you know, squeezing a grape just to see how the juice comes out, testing it. And eventually, you get the first part of the process, which is the picking. And the picking can be done by machine. That is rare in Spain. There are some high-volume winemakers, bodegas, that will produce millions and millions of bottles. And in Australia in particular, New World, they will use machinery because of the production is so large.
I'm wondering what that machinery is. I mean, having done a Vendange
basically
with secateurs.
It's a tractor with sort of vertical, horizontal, like a trellis thing, which grabs the shakes as it goes along, shakes left and right down the channel of the vines, and will shake the cepas, the actual vine,
yes,
and the grapes will come out, and then they're picked, so, and they're collected.
The grapes then fall off the bunches.
It's the same as olive. You know, you've seen in olives they shake the tree, and it all comes into what do they call them, cloths on the floor, and then they grab
the nets.
Well,
yeah.
that is for high production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that sounds like. Yeah, it can't do the vine
in No. In Europe, predominantly, it's hand-picked. And you'll have teams of skilled, you know, people who have done this before. A team
people
of people.
Like us, I think.
Well, people who haven't necessarily done it before, yeah. This is actually
the
40th anniversary. This time, exactly 40 years ago, we were slogging up and down a vineyard in Corbière, very slowly, with two Spanish families who were, like, massively quick. And the Brits were at the back, the three of us. It really was. It was embarrassing. Mm. Yes.
No, I mean, you know, the great payoff of doing, you know, having that experience is when you have the lunch and you have the wine afterwards. But these people have done it over and over again.
The wine was revolting.
Okay.
We got 5 liters a day. It was undrinkable. Absolutely. Yeah.
But anyway, they would pick the grapes, and these would be put in containers. Maximum 10 to 15 kilo containers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole point about picking is that as little damage as possible is caused or to the grape itself. You don't want the grape to start juicing, as it were, to start releasing its juice and tearing its skin. You want to get it on the processed in terms of picking on the conveyor belt, which is what they do. And for red wine, they will destem it. That's very important. But for white wine, they won't. They'll just squeeze it and get the juice out. But that's a very important thing, right? So you'll notice when you read things about winemaking and certain bodegas, they'll make a point of telling you, you know, that it's a 10-kilo basket or it's a 15-kilo basket. And the point of that is if it's a bigger basket, you put more in it and it'll squeeze the ones at the bottom. So you don't want that to happen. So that's the first stage. And also picking, as we said before, it's the timing of the picking, not the actual process of picking. You know, and it's really important that once the decision is taken, it's been taken in the light of days and days and days and days of study and worry of when it's the right time to do it. That moment comes, all action stations, there's no turning back, and let's get these grapes in as quickly as possible. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
And then that's the first stage. Then there's the sorting. So white wine, eventually some rosé wine, but mainly red wine, particularly in Rioja and Ribera, it'll be red. You will then get them destemmed. And then there's the next process, which is once you've got the grapes, you need to get the juice out. So most of that is going to happen by what's called a free run, which is just natural gravity and pressure is going to release up to about 80% of the juice.
Just them sitting there?
Sitting there, yeah, processing them, stacking them, it'll start to come out. And all that would be pumped into the vats for fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
But then a second main decision has to be taken, and that is, what do they do with what's left in the red wine, which is the must, which is the pumice, which is the gloop. What we would do in the garden, we would call compost, you know, all that. That can also be pressed by a machine, and that's very important because that 20% of what's left of the free run after the free run can actually produce up to 30% more juice. But of course, that juice is more affected by the tannins and the minerals and the twigs and the leaves and everything that's in the must.
Mm.
So
what are the considerations for using that then?
It all depends on the quality of the harvest, the quality of the grape and the quality of the juice that comes out, the sugar content. All this is determined by the winemaker. And these are the hidden talents of some of the top winemakers.
So that affects the desirability of the must.
And also, absolutely, whether it's to be used or not, correct.
Whether it's to be used or not.
And if it's, but generally it is used in part, and that is an area, I wanted to say that because it's something that people don't really think about, but it actually
but
works.
Is it added?
Yeah, it can be added or not.
To the first press, as it were.
Yeah, the first run of the juice.
So you've got the first run, and then there's the second run.
Correct.
You put that in there, and then mix them both together.
If or not. They may or may not. It depends on all kinds of things. I mean, one of the things I'm going to be telling you about now is the next most important part, which is the fermentation, in order to get the alcohol into it. I'm sure people know this, but, you know, quick sort of science lesson. I mean, basically what happens is that there is a natural fermentation in grape. For example, there are some Beaujolais in France that are made, because that's a young wine that's not barreled, it's just bottled, that is made from a natural... the grapes will have a little powder on them, and that is actually yeast. Mm-hmm. And it's a natural yeast in the compound of the grape. And that will, if... you know, press and left long enough, it'll produce alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's never enough.
You see that, don't you? It's just like a bloom on the grape.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I'm trying to say is that in olden times, that never quite finished the process. So the alcohol was very low and it didn't last very long, the wine. Today, we add yeast, particularly to red wine, in order to make it last. So they will add yeast, and it's the cells of the yeast that eat the sugar that produces the ethanol, which is the alcohol. And it's that process that gives us the percentage of volume of alcohol in the wine. And what's interesting, again, some people may not know this, is that 1 gram of sugar, let me get this right, because I've written it down. Yeah, 1 gram of sugar produces about 0.5 gram of alcohol. So when you see on a bottle 12% or 13%, That means that the 12%, for example, has needed 24% of sugar. So when it's at the pumice stage, when it's at the must stage, there is a thing called the weight of must that can be calculated laboratory as to how much sugar there is at that stage. And that is one of the factors that decides whether they're going to use the pressing, extra pressing of the must to be able
sugar,
to add it.
Because that contains sugar.
If the sugar of the free run is very high, they may not bother. If it isn't, they will use it. And they can also, if they want to get some wines that are very strong, very powerful at 15 or 14.5%, what's the answer? They add sugar, and that creates more, and add yeast, and that creates more more alcohol. So that's
so
what
it's not
it
literally
means.
Sugar. It's the must.
No. The sugar is it's the yeast eating the sugar. The cells of the yeast that eats when you get a cell eating the sugar, it creates CO2. It creates energy.
Yeah.
And that energy is the byproduct of that energy is CO2, which is lost in atmospherically. Mm. And then you're left with ethanol, which is the alcohol.
So what you've described is fermentation.
Yeah, that is almost stage two. And then fermentation then leads to a very important thing, really important, which is completely forgotten often, but mentioned in tasting notes, technical notes, and that is the maltation. And that is where, when you get to the fermentation stage, you've got malactic acid, and that is bad. That is the sharp, bitter, very acidic green apple type of taste. So in red wine, that's not good. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they use a friendly good bacteria that converts that to lactic acid, and that produces the soft, creamy, you know, taste in red wine. And that's the next stage. And then it goes back into fermentation, and then it goes into aging.
I think we need
aging.
A flow chart here.
So then it goes back into fermentation. Now, some wines are stored in bottles, some wines go into barrels. This is the next part of the process? Or
We are still at the stage of these massive 60,000-litre stainless steel vats.
Yeah.
One thing I want to say, which is really important, and you're looking at the time, yes, we're going to finish now on this part, is that on the white wines, there are no grapes involved in the pressing. In other words, they are just crushed, juice comes out, and then it's fermented. Whereas in red wine, it's the skin of the grape, which is why it has to be fermented with the grape, that gives it its color.
Okay.
And that's the biggest difference between the fermentation between whites, rosés, and reds.
Is there a difference in the actual grape type?
That what?
Between red and white. And rosé.
No, inside they're all green. It's just the skin. But they are obviously different.
So that is what discerns a white wine from a red wine.
The skin.
It's not grape type. It's
you
the
can
fact
actually
that
make white wine from red grapes, actually, but you remove the skin.
Mm-hmm.
If you see what I mean. Right. For example, champagne will use a Pinot Noir to make champagne. It's not red. That's because they get rid of the skin.
Just what are the main grape types that we should be familiar with? Just give us, like, you know, here we are. I'm a layman. I'm trying to talk my way into a wine circle. What should I know? Garnacha, Pinot Noir. Well, what? Just give us give us a sample, Richard.
Absolutely. In white, you're looking at Chardonnay. You're looking at Sauvignon Blanc. You're looking in Spain at Verdejo. Those are the main white grapes,
right? Yes.
On reds, in Europe, you're looking at Cabernet Sauvignon, you're looking at Cabernet Franc, you're looking at Syrah or Shiraz, same grape, Tempranillo in Spain, Garnacha, Graciano is another one, Merlot, Malbec. Malbec is more synonymous with Argentina, but nevertheless,
yes,
it's still available. And the other one is Petit Verdot. Now, Petit Verdot is a superb grape. But it's only used as a percentage on a blend of a red wine.
Okay, and one more question before we break for another break. Fortified wines like sherry, vino fino, how do they occur? They start presumably as ordinary wine, or am I way off beam here?
No, you're not way off.
If that's an irrelevant question, you tell me.
But we'll go to the break. That'll take another half hour.
Oh,
it's
okay.
A completely different process of making wine.
But they start. It starts from.
No, you pick the grape, the Palomino grape, and then it goes. It goes depending on the sherry you're going to produce, which is basically determined by the barrel and the alcohol content. You use what's called the Solera system, which I will stop there, because that will not that I don't know, I do know, but it will just take time to explain.
Okay, before we disappear down that particular red herring, we're going to take a break now. We'll see you afterwards.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At home with the Hogs.
Welcome back. We're in conversation with Richard Bell Young, and we're talking all about wine. Do feel free to get involved. 952-784-4000 is the number to call. Richard, we're describing the maturing process of red wine, and we got to the huge 60-litre stainless steel vats, and now we're going to the next phase.
Yeah, I mean, just to go over it a little bit quickly, it'll then, in red wine, it will then go through a process of aging, which involves wood, oak wood, and in different periods. Different quality of wine from the same harvest will be given an aging process for a few months, for over a year, for over 2 years, up to 4 years, before it is bottled and then released into the marketplace.
Can it age for too long?
Good question. Probably, because then they lose money.
Oh.
Because, you know, the longer it is being aged and then bottled, the longer it takes to get to the market and get your return. So it's a commercially driven thing. I think it reaches a point where it has enough tannins and has enough aging to be able to be laid down and drunk either immediately or in 15, 20 years' time. So that, and also the quality of the grape, the age of the grape, of the vine, etc., will determine whether it's a young wine or a long matured wine before it is
because
released.
The wine doesn't keep indefinitely, does it? It's not like a brandy or
no.
Something. Some, you were talking yesterday about the word plenitude.
La plenitud. There comes in wine, red wine in particular, it has a period of time, quite a steep line, and then it reaches a plateau line, which can be 1 year, it can be 10 years, it can be 20 years, it can be 100 years, before which it starts to die. It literally starts to, die. It reaches a point where it's going to start losing its fruit, and that's when the wine starts to die in the bottle.
And changes colour, interestingly.
Yes, it does. I mean, a wine that is beginning to reach the end of its plenitude, its best time to be drunk, essentially, that is when it starts going a terracotta, sort of a reddish, brownish, lighter color, because it's literally losing its fruit. And you'll see that as flakes at the bottom of the glass. And as the pigment of color from the grape in the wine starts to die, it'll literally fall, and you'll get the alcohol and the liquid and the orangey.
Yeah, and interesting, there are sort of eclectic connoisseurs who actually prefer the wine at this.
There
stage.
Are...
They seek out a wine.
That is a better way of putting it. I wouldn't show that there are some people who pay an awful lot of money to have the experience of drinking a wine that was at its peak, probably the best wine in the world, 50 years ago, and have the opportunity to actually have tasted it, perhaps at its plenitude, and also start to see it a taste that you wouldn't normally come across.
Yes, sort of like an appreciation of autumn or something.
Yeah, in its twilight years.
So I've got a bottle of red wine here in front of me, and it appears to me to have four distinguishing features. It's got a name, Protos, so that's easy. That's its mark. It's got its date, 2017. And then it's got two things that require explanation. It calls itself crianza. What's that?
Okay. In Spain, the process of aging wine is known as the process of crianza. And it has different stages. And the stages are determined by the minimum of time it needs to spend in the barrel and the wood barrel and the bottle that is set by the regulator of that particular area of winemaking in Spain. So, to confuse everybody, when you see, although it is known as the crianza, one of the stages happens to be called crianza as well. And in Rioja, for example, that is a minimum of 12 months. So if you have a wine that is aging 11 and a half months, you cannot call it a crianza. If it's aged 12 months or more, you can call it a crianza.
Which means it's spent at least a year
in barrel and at least a year in bottle before it is released. That determines the date on the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, if it is harvested in 2019 and it's going to become a crianza, it'll spend 2020 in oak and then 2021 before it is released in the bottle.
Too right. So if you go to the supermarket now and see a bottle 2019 Crianza, you know it's not a Crianza. It cannot be.
You've just hit it on the nail. That's exactly the reason why the regulator insists on putting the date of the wine, because then you can determine by what it says Crianza that it is a Crianza. It could be a Reserva. A Reserva would have a minimum in Rioja of 18 months in the barrel and then 18 months in bottle. A Gran Reserva would be anything above 18 months, which can be up to, like Ardanza, is 4 years.
Ardanza?
So Ardanza is another make of wine. And that is known to have got a long aging process.
Okay.
So, and a younger wine.
Tinto Joven is prior to
a Tinto Joven, normally cosecha, means there's no barrel. It's like a Beaujolais.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got semi-crianza, which is probably about 3 or 4 or 5 months, mm-hmm. up to 12 months. And then you've got seleccionados. People forget about seleccionados. Seleccionados are wines that are young, or can be also aged, but are specially picked grapes of the harvest that are considered to be particularly good, and so they create a separate category of one of the Crianza stages.
Okay, so the other thing that we've got on this bottle is a denominación de origen.
The DO.
Which says Ribera del Duero.
Yeah.
Explain, that's where the wine is from. Explain to us about DOs.
Right, imagine that Spain is a continent known as the wine continent. And imagine that within the continent, that lots and lots of little, it's a republic, and in there you've got lots and lots of little states. And those states of winemaking are known as DOs. And they all have their own regulator. They are governed by a general standard of winemaking, which involves hygiene and all sorts of things, production, price, everything. But each one has their own idiosyncrasy, laws and rules, governed by the regulator. That's what a DO is. And there are 67 DOs in Spain, of which 26 are very well known,
mm-hmm.
like Rioja, Ribera and others.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other types of winemaking areas in Spain as well, in addition to that, that are not DOs. For example, you have Pagos, and there are only 17 Pagos in Spain. And those 17 Pagos are like a Monaco within France. It's like their own, it's like a separate wine country within the continent of wine called Spain, if you see what I mean. And they can only produce wine from the grapes on their farms. They can't buy grapes or share grapes or do anything. It's a Pago. It's much higher standard, and there's only 17 of them.
Oh, so that is a higher standard than a DO.
It's a single state. In France, you've got single vineyards, and in Spain, they call them Pagos.
Right, and those are highly sought after.
Not necessarily. Some are not considered to be very good wines.
Right.
But some, all the variants come in wherever the wine is made, but they are considered to be the highest, the most difficult way of most risky way. So generally, they tend to be very, they tend to be old farms, well established. They feel confident, you know, and they seek that status, and they become very exclusive. But some are amazing, and some are not.
But there's only 17 of them
in Spain at the moment.
Pagos. Now, Richard, let's just talk about you for a while. Yeah, you've recently opened an outlet. It's called Vino Market. It's in San Enrique de Guadiaro, which is just in Cadiz. And you sell wine, spirits to private market and to the trade. And we visited you yesterday, and it reminded us a little bit. I mean, it was thoroughly ambient. It reminded us a little bit of Oddbins.
Yes,
if you remember
really nice
Oddbins
smell.
back in England.
Wooden wine.
You've got a wide variety of wines there. How do you research those wines?
Okay, before I answer that, let me explain how Vino Market was born.
Mm.
And it's a massive advantage to all our private customers. Over the 10 years ago, I was selling probably 90% of my wines to private customers. Over the last 3 or 4 years, it's now about 80% to the trade. And what that has done is it's given me the opportunity to buy more direct, in fact, all of it direct now, and very much at the best prices. And I buy volume because I'm supplying to the trade. So what I've done is I've binned, pardon the pun, the retail side. I've gone wholesale, and I'm passing all the wholesale prices to private clients. So that's the birth of Vino Market. It is a move away from retail, where I would have to buy through distributors because I'm buying low volume over the years. Over the years, I've increased my volume of purchasing power, and therefore I can pass the benefit of the buying at better prices because I'm supplying a distribution on the coast to lots of restaurants and hotels, etc.
Oh, it's restaurants and hotels.
Yeah, that's the trade.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when a customer comes in now to Vino Market, they will kick off with wholesale prices. And before, there wouldn't be. There'd be a difference between what I sell to a restaurant and what I sell in the retail shop.
Mm.
Obviously.
But private punters can come in, like Penn and I, or like the bloke who comes in and buys a can of Fanta on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Come in, have a glass of wine.
There's a little bit of a caveat there, Richard, get a glass of wine?
There is a little pledge, yes.
A teeny-weeny one.
Tell us about
it's sold to my husband.
€500 pledge.
Yeah, a €500 pledge over 12 months. So,
that's,
you know, we are asking clients we do not know to have a sort of psychological commitment. But it's really just a bit of marketing fun. I mean, at the end of the day, I want to pass on the benefits of the growth of the business over the last 10 years to private clients.
Yeah.
And I think it's the right way to go. And we will have a website. We will have an online shop very soon. And, you know, we will be showing this is the retail price, but look at our wholesale price. And what is that? Economy of scale. And I think that's the way retail is going to go. And I've anticipated it. You know, in favour of those loyal customers that have been with me for the last 10 years.
Before the time drips away, how can people listening get in touch with you? You're saying, do you have a website? Is there a way of...
There is a website. It obviously, with Vino Market, we've had to change it. And it's been built. And there is a message online that says that. But we will have it on very soon. But everybody, trade or private... They all, I'm sorry, but they all WhatsApp me. That's what I do. My office is my phone. So
664-805-905-958.
I literally get people who are in a restaurant, they send me photographs of wine, and I either source the wine for them, tell them about it, show them an alternative, and that's how that's what happens. And I do that with trade as well as private, and I love it. That's
okay, Richard, one minute to go back to my original question. How do you source your wine?
I source my wines by going and tasting all the wines. I never, ever, ever have a wine that in my normal range that would I have not tasted or visited. And in fact, in 2 weeks' time, I shall be in Rioja on my annual visit.
Oh, brilliant. How nice. That must be very lovely.
Trust me, you don't want to come with me. No, Kate.
I would love to come with you.
No,
wine tasting evening we had.
Take him with you.
The
wine tasting evening we had last summer was absolutely brilliant.
It's great fun.
Yeah, yeah. So, really, really good to talk to you. And
when are you doing the course?
Yeah, that's what we wanted to ask.
We think you should be teaching people
very
about wine.
Definitely.
I mean,
people should be going to Vino Market for an evening of tasting and information.
One of the things I'm doing is holding a lot of tastings in all the golf clubs in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very well in with Atalaya, El Paraíso, Aloha, Las Brisas, Los Naranjos, all those places I'm holding tastings. And that's the best way I'm reaching people.
Quaffing golfers. That's
not during the golf, though.
So look, we are teetering towards the timeline when we bid you goodbye.
Well, thank you for having me. Seriously, I love
Richard,
it.
Richard, thank you so much.
No
Eric
problem.
Eric Hersey from The Spanish Touch, thank you very much. And thank you very much for being with us this morning. And if you want second helpings, this program is repeated on air Thursdays at 6 o'clock on demand at the TRE website. We've been Penn and Kid.
We have.
And until next Saturday, take very good care.
Take care. See you then.
Have a great weekend. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.